Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
What is the relationship between the Hebrew Bible and ancient Near Eastern myths? Combining theories of metaphor and narrative, Paul Cho argues that the Hebrew Bible is more deeply mythological than previously recognized. Tune in as we talk with Paul Cho about the sea myth in the Hebrew Bible, the subject addressed in his recent book, Myth, History, and Metaphor in the Hebrew Bible. That's by Cambridge University Press, 2019. You're listening to New Books in Biblical Studies, a channel of the New Books Network, and I'm Michael Morales, your host. Paul Cho is Assistant Professor of Hebrew Bible at Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. His articles have been published in Catholic Biblical Quarterly and in the Journal of Biblical Literature. Paul, welcome to New Books in Biblical Studies.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Now, Paul, there are different conceptions of myth. You refer to myth as story and metaphor. Would you explain that for us?
Yeah, so the defining myth is a tricky matter, and very few scholars will agree on a definition. So I just propose a working definition. It goes something like this. I say that myth is a story about weighty matters involving deities, human beings, and other personalities that, in the understanding of its adherents, reveal something true about the real world, real order of the world. And I emphasize that myth is a story, and that I also pick up, I propose that we should look at myth as a metaphor to get at the notion of the fact that some people think of it as revealing something true about the world. So most students of myth will agree that myth is a story, but very few theories of myth, in fact, take that into great consideration or delve into that very much. But in my book, I try to emphasize that myth is a story. And what this does for us is that we are able to dissect myth into its component parts and use those component parts as a way of analyzing myth and the effect that myth has on the Hebrew Bible. So the component parts that I look at, taking them from Aristotle, is verbal expression, the language that the myth will use, the characters that populate the myth, the thought or the themes that the myth deals with, and finally, and for my purposes, the most importantly, the plot or the narrative structure of myth as story. So that's the myth as story part, and I also propose that we should look at myth as metaphor, because I think that gets at the ways in which myth can be understood to reveal something true about the real order of the world. And I divide, so the first thing is that I argue is that all the components of a story, namely the language, the characters, the themes, as well as the plot, the narrative structure of a story, can be used as a metaphor of some sort. So that gives us a good way of kind of looking at the ways in which myth influences the Hebrew Bible. The second part that I want to emphasize is that when we're talking about metaphor, and so myth as a metaphor, we're really talking about two things. One, the metaphorical participants, that is the two things or more things that can be compared to one another, A or B, and then the metaphorical copula, the A is part, the A is B, the is part. And I said that A, the metaphorical participants, can be any of those things that we discussed, verbal expression, characters, themes, plot. And what is important to realize about the metaphorical copula is that what I argue is that it actually creates something new, it creates a new meaning, and going beyond that, creates a new being in the world. I trace the drama that is contained in the metaphorical copula in this way. When you say A is B, you're creating a metaphor. But what we should realize is that when we say A is B, let's say men are pigs, we don't literally mean men are pigs. So the foundation of a metaphor is, to a certain extent, built upon a lie, a categorical mistake. That is to say, men are not pigs, but we say men are pigs. So, so we might think that, well, does a metaphor mean that men are like pigs, or is it a simile? But then I think when we use a metaphor, we mean something stronger than a simile. Men are like pigs, but rather that men are pigs. And when we think about that, the emphasis on the is, we realize that by using a metaphor, by creating a metaphor, especially novel metaphors, we are creating new meaning for one or the other parts of the metaphor. So you're creating a new meaning. But as soon as you take the metaphor outside of the arena of linguistics, but into the world, we actually create something, what we call a new being. And more expansively, what I argue in the book is that if you think about the plot of an entire story being used as a metaphor, we are able to, in fact, create a new world. So in emphasizing that this myth is a story and as a metaphor, I'm trying to get at a new way of analyzing myth and its influence in the Hebrew Bible.
In your third chapter, you rehearse sea myths of the ancient Near East. One of these is the Baal cycle from Ugarit. Tell us about that sea myth.
Yeah, the Baal cycle readers of the Hebrew Bible will be familiar with the character of Baal. Baal is usually appears in the pages of the Hebrew Bible as an idol or the false god that the Israelites are reprimanded for worshiping. But we actually have an entire cycle of myths, cycle of stories about this deity. And it comes from, as you mentioned, from Ugarit. And Ugarit is a port city in modern day Syria. And it seems to have been destroyed in the 13th century BCE. And we discovered its literary troves back in 1929. And since then, scholars have been studying this myth and have been discovering that it actually gives us a lot of insight into the background of the ancient Near Eastern world, and including the Hebrew Bible. This myth about Baal is about a conflict between Baal, who is the protagonist deity here, and Yam, the god of the sea, who is the bad guy in this story. So Baal, in the beginning of the story, loses his kingship to Yam. And then Baal engages in a series of conflicts with Yam to regain that kingship. And it's important to remember that Baal in this cycle is not a bad deity, but rather the good deity, the deity who stands in for order and life and fertility. Baal is a storm god, and so as the one who is responsible for sending rain and therefore the ability, fertility into the land, Baal is a god of life to a certain extent. And Yam, on the other hand, symbolizes disorder and chaos and kind of the anti-life forces. And so in this myth, Baal defeats Yam in a battle. And as a consequence, Baal wins back his kingship. But these are not only, kingship is not the only thing that is a result of Baal's victory over Yam. He also is able to create, build a temple, which to a certain extent concretizes his kingship. But his temple is also related to his role as creator. This second claim that Baal is creator is contested among scholars, but I think it becomes fairly clear that Baal's victory over Yam has something to do with creation in the fact that when Baal engaged in another battle with the deity Mot, the god of death, and dies, all the earth begins to die out. The plant life withers away, and therefore life itself seems to die. And it is only when Baal comes back to life that he is able to send rain, probably from his temple, that life returns to creation. So Baal may not be responsible for creating the cosmos per se, but Baal is responsible as creator, for the continuation of life on earth. So Baal defeats Yam, the god of the sea, and as a consequence, he regains his kingship, he builds a temple, and he sustains life in creation. So that's the basic storyline of the Baal cycle. And I think that myth has been quite influential and enlightening for our understanding of the Hebrew Bible as well.
In the rest of your book, you relate the sea myth to the Hebrew Bible's accounts of creation, the Exodus, the exile, and the eschaton. So how does the sea myth function in relation to the creation account?
Yeah, so in the book, I look at the relationship between sea myths on the one hand and creation accounts in the Hebrew Bible in two locations. First, I look at the various ways in which we can see the sea myth influencing accounts of creation in the book of Psalms. And I also deal with the relationship between the sea myths and Genesis chapter 1, when we have the priestly account of creation. And I think I can briefly kind of give a summary of the ways in which I see the sea myth influencing the creation account in Genesis 1. So I first looked at the language that carries over from ancient Near Eastern sea myths into the creation account in Genesis 1. The first instance of this is quite famous, is the appearance of the deep, or to whom, in Genesis chapter 1, verse 2. It says that darkness is over the deep, or to whom. And though there is some debate about this, I think most scholars will agree that to whom is a reflex of the sea deity in the Babylonian version of the sea myth called the Enuma Elish. There, instead of having Yam, we have the deity named Tiamat, which probably refers to the salty ocean, as the antagonist. And it is through the defeat of Tiamat that Marduk, the Babylonian deity, is able to create both the cosmos and, to a certain extent, human beings. And what we have in Genesis 1-2 is perhaps a reflection, a depersonalized reflection of this Tiamat deity as to whom. And the second kind of language we can see coming from the sea myth in Genesis 1 is the firmament in Genesis chapter 1, verse 6, when God, on the second day, creates a firmament to divide the waters above and the waters below. And a similar thing actually happens in the Enuma Elish, where Marduk, after killing Tiamat, takes the carcass, divides it in half, and then kind of puts one half up in the heavens to block out the waters above, and that's the firmament. And the other half kind of creates the earth, the land, to keep out the waters below. So we have probably the same theme being played out in Genesis 1 there. And then perhaps the clearest reference to the sea myth in terms of verbal expression comes in Genesis 1, verse 21, where God is in fact seen creating what should be translated as sea dragons, taninim in the Hebrew. And this is a direct reflex of the fact that sometimes the sea deities are equated or identified with the sea monsters, the tanin, the sea dragons. And here we have God not only creating these kind of cosmic forces of chaos, but rather in fact blessing these dragons, these sea dragons. So we have the verbal kind of the language being borrowed from the sea myths, but of course the priestly writers are doing something very different with each theme, each motif. So we have clear kind of connections between Genesis 1 and this ancient Near Eastern sea myths. And this also comes out in the fact that the themes that are dealt with in Genesis 1 reflect the themes that we see in the sea myths. We saw that the consequence of God's victory over the God of the sea is creation, temple, and kingship. And that's precisely what we find in Genesis 1 as well. Obviously, we have in Genesis 1 an account of creation. So creation is obviously an important aspect of Genesis 1. And we also see the temple. And what we see is that the entire creation, especially the earth, is presented in Genesis 1 as God's temple. It is, so instead of building a separate structure in which God resides, rather the entire cosmos, the entire creation is presented as God's temple. This has a large kind of theological implication. If the entire cosmos, all of creation is God's temple, then it logically precludes the possibility that other temples for other gods can be built. So there is a clear, but if subtle, claim for the kingship and so the godship of the God of Israel alone. And this theme of creation and temple is connected to God's kingship. We know that from the ancient Near Eastern world, including the Hebrew Bible, that when God enters the temple, God is to a certain extent being enthroned as king and entering not rest per se, but entering into the beginning of God's reign as king. So what we have in Genesis 1 are the verbal expressions that make the connection between Genesis 1 and the sea myths very clear, and then also the themes that to a certain extent concretize that. What we don't find is a direct reflection of the plot or the narrative structure of ancient sea myths in Genesis 1. We have, of course, creation, temple, and kingship, but what is missing in Genesis 1 is the theme of conflict. God does not create or become king as a result of a victory in battle, but rather simply is creator and simply is king. And so we don't have the entire story being of ancient Near Eastern sea myths represented or replicated in Genesis 1, because we don't have the theme of conflict. But what I would say is that, that what Genesis has done is to remove the theme of conflict to the arena that is outside of the text. So that what in other sea myths is a conflict that happens within the story. Conflict in Genesis 1 becomes extra textual. It happens, first of all, in the theological discourse that the priestly writers, who probably authored Genesis 1, are having with the theological claims of a other semit, such as the Babylonian Enuma Elish, which says that, well, if Marduk created the heavens and the earth through conflict, well, the God of Israel creates without conflict, because there is no possibility for any force, any power that can, in fact, battle against the God of Israel. And I think the second extra textual conflict happens in the mind of the readers and the hearers of this story, when the ancient audience would have heard Genesis 1 being read or read out loud, they would have been shocked by the fact that creation is happening without a conflict. And they would have understood that this theological program of the priestly writers is at odds with, and to a certain extent is in conflict with, the theological claims of both the Canaanite neighbors as well as the Babylonian captors of the Israelites. So that's how I see the Semith being played out and transformed in Genesis 1.
In your chapter on the Semith and the eschaton, you discuss two biblical texts, Isaiah 24 through 27 and Daniel 7. Would you give our listeners an idea of how the Semith functions in one of these passages?
Sure. So if we see in Genesis 1 the Semith being transformed in the biblical account of creation, we have in Isaiah 24 to 27 and also in Daniel 7 and following, the transformation of the Semith as an account of what will happen in the eschaton, that is to say, to a certain extent, in the end of history. So eschaton and eschatology has to do with the end things, and both Isaiah 24 to 27 and Daniel 7 are conceptualized as happening at the logical end of historical time. So we're entering into the eschatological era, and in both passages we have something like not the exact replication, but something like the Semith occurring. I think we can look at Isaiah 24:27. Isaiah 24 to 27 has been called the Isaiah Apocalypse, but many scholars, I think most scholars, don't think that the generic ascription of apocalypse to these chapters is correct. But I think they do deal with what we might call the eschatological era. And we have here again the Semith being transformed as a metaphor for describing events that the writers believe will happen in the end of time. Really, a striking example of this comes in chapter 27, verse 1, in which reads, "On that day, the Lord will punish with his cruel and great and strong sword, Leviathan, the fleeing serpent, Leviathan, the twisting serpent. He will kill the dragon that is in the sea." What is remarkable here is that this passage seems to be almost an exact quotation from what we find in the Baal cycle. In Baal cycle tablet 5, we have this saying, "When you," referring to Baal, "when you struck down Litan." Litan is the Ugaritic version of Leviathan. And Litan is described in the exact same words that we find in Isaiah 27. It says, "When you struck down Litan, the fleeing serpent, annihilated the twisty serpent, the potentate with seven heads." So what we have in 27:1 is not only a verbal repetition, verbatim repetition of what we find in the Baal cycle, but also the very characters that we find there. Not Baal, but the Lord is the protagonist who will fight the dragon called Leviathan in the Bible and Litan in the Baal cycle. So we have the theme of conflict and, of course, the presumed victory of God over the forces of chaos represented by this dragon. And then what we find in the rest of Isaiah 24 to 27 are the consequences of God's victory. We expect to see creation, kingship, and temple, and those three are precisely what we find as the consequence of God's victory or the God's future victory over Leviathan. First, we see the theme of creation in these chapters. In Isaiah 24, the first chapter of what is called the Isaiah Apocalypse, is an imagining as a depiction of the earth, all of earth to a certain extent, as a vegetative world, perhaps even as a garden or a olive grove. And what's happening to earth as a result of some sins that the people have committed, is that the earth as a garden is being dried up and being withered away. It's being devoured. So we have the garden, the earth as a garden, kind of dying out. But in Isaiah 27 verses 2 to 6, the passage immediately following God's battle against Leviathan is a poem in which God imagines a pleasant garden, a pleasant vineyard. So we see God being reimagined to a certain extent as a gardener and making this garden come back to life. And the kind of the worldwide implication becomes clear at the end of that poem in verse 6 when it says, in days to come, Jacob will take root, Israel will sprout and blossom. Then the face of the world will be filled with fruit. So what is happening is God defeats the dragon, the forces of chaos and death. And then Israel is the first to come back to life. And from there, life and fertility spreads throughout all creation. So we have the renewal of creation as a direct result of this kind of cosmic victory of God over Leviathan. Also in play is the kingship of God. This is, to a certain extent, very clear in chapter 24, verse 23, in which it simply says, the Lord of hosts will reign, or perhaps better, the Lord of hosts will be king on Mount Zion and in Jerusalem. So the kingship of God is in question. And we see God to a certain extent exercising God's kingship in chapter 24 and 25, in which we see God judging the hosts of heaven and also the kings of the earth, as well as holding an eschatological feast of sorts, in which God, in fact, I would say, devours death. And of course, this probably is a reflex of the Baal cycle in which God battles where Baal battles the god of death called Mot. And so we have creation, kingship, and also the temple. And the temple is implied in the image of Zion and Jerusalem, and also of the image of the garden coming back, because those are all related motifs. But it becomes very clear towards the end of chapter 27, which reads, "And on that day, a great trumpet will be blown, and those who were lost in the land of Assyria and those who were driven out to the land of Egypt will come and worship the Lord on the holy mountain at Jerusalem." So what we have here, obviously, is people who have been scattered abroad coming back to the temple in Jerusalem to worship God once again. So we have, I think, in Isaiah 24 to 27, the language, the characters, the themes, as well as the plot of Semith's being replicated in a very interesting way, as something that, so in ancient Near Eastern Semith's, these things occur in the past, in the prological era. But here, that what happened in the past, what happened in the kind of the founding events of the world, is being projected into the eschaton, into the end times, as something that will happen perhaps once again, as a reinstatement of God's creative kingship over the world.
Now, Paul, tell us a little bit more about yourself and how you got interested in this topic.
Yeah, I think my answer to that will be twofold. Anyone who enters into the critical study of the Hebrew Bible will have encountered these sea myths probably in the very first class that they hear on the Hebrew Bible. As we discussed, the sea myth plays an important part in the writing and the conceptualization of creation in Genesis 1. So it's very likely that that students will hear about the sea myth the first day that they encounter the critical study of the Hebrew Bible. And that was certainly the case for me. And I think I began to be fascinated by this aspect of the Hebrew Bible and the traditions that informed its writing and its conceptualization. So that's one. But more specifically, I kind of became more interested in writing and researching this topic when I was taking a seminar on Exodus chapters 13 to 15, the sea event, with Professor John Levinson. And it's there in that class that I came to realize the complex, sophisticated, and very interesting ways in which the sea myths of the ancient Near East informs and, in fact, really and makes possible the kind of writing that we find in Exodus 13, 14, and 15. So that's what I decided to write about this topic, and then from there it kind of blossomed to the other areas. The other avenue by which I came to write about this topic is my kind of ongoing interest in metaphor theory as a student of literature. I was a comparative literature major as an undergraduate, and so I've been interested in literary theory for quite some time. But then I got very much very interested in metaphor theory when I began my MDiv degree, and when I was at Yale, I was introduced to kind of this whole field of metaphor theory by Professor Benjamin Harshab, who passed away a few years ago, and he has been very influential in my thinking about this topic. As well as Christopher Johnson, Professor Christopher Johnson at Harvard, who with whom I took a course on metaphor and metaphor theory, and so I think there are two areas, two avenues by which I came to be really interested in this: the whole the notion of how ancient Near Eastern myths, what role they played in the conceptualization and writing of the Hebrew Bible, as well as kind of this methodological and hermeneutical question of metaphor.
It's been great hearing about your recent book, Paul. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Friends, you've been listening to New Books in Biblical Studies, a channel of the New Books Network. Until next time, goodbye.